Hello and welcome to Science Right Now, our journal of creative writing and art inspired by science. My name is Jess White and today I'm in conversation with Danielle Clode, an award-winning author of Australian non-fiction books. Her writing includes natural history, essays, science writing, historical fiction and best-selling children's books, as well as documentaries. So we're going to talk about two of Danielle's books, In Search of the Woman Who Sailed the World and The Wasp and the Orchid, The Remarkable Life of Australian Naturalist Edith Coleman, and particularly want to look at the ways that women's contributions to natural history tend to be overlooked, though we may veer off into other topics. So I'd like to start with Jeanne Barrée, which is talking about the pronunciation. Can you recap?
Yes,
how you pronounce it?
It is a little tricky. French, and I'm not particularly fluent in French, but I understand that the female form is Jeanne, and the male form, which she also used, is Jean.
So okay, it's
just a slight difference.
How long did it take you to find that out?
Yeah, quite a while actually.
Okay. Oh, that's good. So Jeanne. That's right, Jeanne?
Yes.
Yeah, good. Yeah. Okay. There was the first recorded woman to have circumnavigated the world. So can you tell me how you came across her and what prompted you to write about her?
Well, I guess I came across her story when I was researching one of my earlier books on voyages to the South Seas, where I was looking at all of the French scientific voyages that came to Australia. And I didn't actually cover this voyage in particular. That was because Bougainville's voyage didn't quite make it to Australia, and that was the voyage that Jeanne travelled on. But I was always looking for female voices in that book because it was so male-dominated, yeah. Being on sailing ships all the time. Not that women weren't there, it's just that they weren't spoken to, or, you know, so there were women mentioned in the places people went, obviously, but their voices weren't recorded as frequently. So Jeanne came up in that context as another one of those women who was present. I guess the thing that surprised me was on those voyages that there was often a woman on the ship, but very often they didn't leave their own accounts of the voyages.
Okay, was that because they weren't kept or they weren't written, or probably both?
Yeah, in many cases, because women weren't supposed to be on the voyages, it was technically illegal to be on the voyages, they didn't keep records of them, so they're not in the ship's logs. So it's quite well known that a lot of, this happened in the British Navy as well, there were a lot of women on those ships, but they're not recorded in any of the records because they're either wives or, you know, they're travelling incognito or those sorts of things. So they're really quite hidden. And in the case of the French voyages, very often the women were known to be on board, but nobody wanted to admit it because the captains would get in trouble if they were known to have brought women on board.
Wow. So how can you tell us about Jeanne and how she managed to get that far on her journey to circumnavigate the globe?
Yeah. I mean, they're all fascinatingly different accounts. Yeah. They're not all just sort of standard, you know, a woman being brought aboard by a man for, you know, company. they're quite diverse, and Jeanne's a classic example of that, in that she was an assistant to the botanist, and she was, to be fair, probably also his lover, but she primarily came aboard to assist him with his work. So he was permitted to employ a assistant. So she dressed as a man and pretended she'd never met him before and signed herself up at the port before they departed, and travelled for all of the voyage, in fact, dressed as a man.
Wow. So how did you go about doing the research for that? Because a lot of it would have been in French.
Yes. That did stretch my language skills. So fortunately, you know, a lot of material on the French voyages was translated into English. Okay. You know, the published accounts are translated into English because it was a hugely popular topic at the time. So that makes things a lot easier. But the archives are all still in, obviously in French. And that was where I got some of the more interesting information about Jeanne, because we knew the basics, very basic story from Bougainville's account of the voyage. He devotes a page in his many page long book to her. But I wanted to know what else there was apart from this voyage of a few years, where she came from and who she was. So that required me to go and look in the archives. Fortunately, the French are quite obsessive about archives and really, really good at digitising. So it meant that there's a lot of material online.
Oh, that's very helpful. Did that interest in archival history, French archival history, is that related to their early voyages? Because the French were doing a lot of scientific work in Australia, and this whole stream of French names and the coastline of Australia. Mm. Yeah, are those two things related, do you think?
I think our knowledge of them comes from the French are just very good at they're very good at bureaucracy and record keeping and centralizing. They're very good at that. That's apparent in their science as well. Yeah. That they're very keen on centralizing things and keeping records of things. So when the voyages themselves, which span from the 1760s through to 1840s, really is the peak of them. They collected all the records from them. So they weren't like British voyages, which were often sort of a hybrid private public mix, where like Banks had all his collections. He was a private person on the voyage. On the French voyages, everybody was employed by the king or the government of the day, because they went through various different forms of government. And so all of the records belonged to the state. And so they were all collected up. All the journals, the personal diaries, everything had to be collected up and handed over at the end of the voyage. So that gives you a really, if you can find them, that gives you a really rich source of archival material.
Yeah, that's fantastic. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So after working on Jeanne for so long, do you have a sense of what motivated her to go on the voyage? Like, she had a romantic affiliation with the botanist. So that's obviously a strong driver. But do you think she was a bit obsessed with science as well? Do you have that sense, or was there something else altogether?
Yeah, that's what I was looking for. I was definitely looking for that. But I have to say, in the end, I'd have to say no. Okay. I think she was extremely pragmatic. She was a peasant. She was born into the poorest of the poorest class in France. So her family were serfs. They couldn't own property. They couldn't own land. When they died, they handed everything back to the lord of the manor. They're almost a slave class, really. And she was looking to better her position. And I think the only way she saw she could do that was by leaving France and going on this voyage. And she transformed herself in the course of that voyage. And when she returned, she became a very successful, she became the lord of the manor, in effect. She became the person who owned the property. So I actually think her interest was particularly pragmatic. I'm not sure that, I mean, she was very good at doing science, and she was quite well regarded as a botanist by the people she worked with. But I think it was a job for her.
Wow, that's really, very, very interesting. And I think your earlier book, The Wasp and the Orchid, would have given you some tools in writing about Jeanne, because in The Wasp and the Orchid, there's a paucity of information as well. There's not a whole lot around. Mm. Do you want to tell me about her life, Edith's life?
So Edith did leave quite a rich legacy of written material, but it's all professional material. So it's articles, scientific articles and popular science articles. So she was a naturalist in the 1930s. She came out from England as a child and settled in Australia. And in her later years, in her 50s onwards, she embarked on this career as a writer of natural history, and did so very successfully, and was quite well known for her work on orchids. But the private details were missing again. So in both cases, it was the sort of public persona was known, but the private person was quite hidden, and possibly intentionally in both cases. Okay. Edith was a very private person, and her daughters destroyed most of the private records when, or asked for them to be destroyed when they died. So, you know, which presumably was her interest as well. So that gave me a particular challenge in both cases, is how do you write a history for somebody where you don't have acres and acres of archives. Mm. And so I think that gave me that notion of doing a fragmentary biography where I intersperse the known with some more slightly speculative stuff, not made up, but an educated guess as to what's going on. Wow. and filling in the gaps with other sources of information, which might come from my own experiences as a scientist or as a in the case of Jeanne, as somebody who's had a lot to do with boats or those sorts of things.
Okay, can you tell me a bit more about your history and how you use that to fill in the gaps, your science history?
I guess in both cases, you know, I mean, in Jeanne's case, I spent a lot of time on a boat as a child. So my dad has a really strong interest in traditional boats, and I lived on a boat. So that was particularly something I wanted to draw on when I was writing about Jeanne's voyage, because it's, you know, that lived experience of living on the sea. I think it's, obviously my experience was completely different from hers, separated by several centuries, but nonetheless, I think it sort of gives an insight into things that you might not have if you haven't spent much time on boats. And I think also having an insight into how scientists think is a particularly useful tool. So my PhD is in zoology and conservation biology in particular. And I often find when I'm reading about scientists, there's a particular way they think that I think is tricky to get at if you're coming at it from, say, a historian's point of view. Historians think about knowledge and their process, their research process is very different. So I think it's useful to have that background to draw on. So it's a personal input into the person's life, I suppose.
How would you say that scientists think in comparison to other disciplines?
question. I don't know, but it's a little bit hard to say. I guess, you know, they're very focused on the evidence, and you know that not necessarily very. I often find people. It's not that they're not influenced by their culture, the things surrounding them, you know, the cultural impetus around them, but people will, I read, for example, that somebody says, oh, the scientists changed their mind on this position. Whereas when you actually, from my perspective, looking at it as a scientist, I think they've actually, they haven't changed their mind. They've just gone with the evidence. The evidence has accumulated and altered, and so therefore they've gone with the evidence, whereas it's often sort of expressed as a backflip, but that's not a concept that science really has. If the evidence changes, you change. You know, you follow the evidence. You don't have a established position that you're going to stick to through thick and thin. I think things like that are just subtly different.
Yeah. And that's obviously that there in the archival work that you're doing, because I think that looking at archives is like looking at something under a microscope. You're just trying to work out what the hell they're doing and how it all fits together.
I just think that's it. Yeah, that's been a really different skill for me to learn. And I think that's, you know, having that sort of trying to have a slightly interdisciplinary perspective, close reading is something, you know, that I've spent a lot of time doing. And I'm not, by no means, that's not my, you know, that's not my disciplinary background, but I'm aware of the need to do it and how easy it is to misread what, you know, texts, and then all of, you know, like 6 months later I can think, oh no, that's not what they meant.
Yeah.
Not what they were saying. Something else.
Yeah, I was just thinking about the letters of Georgiana Molloy, and they, her tone changed according to who she was writing to. So when she was writing to her mother, it was a different tone to writing to James Mangles, who she was sending her botanical specimens to. But regardless of who she was writing to, she still would have never completely revealed herself, because those letters would have been exchanged among the family. And for her to talk about her loneliness and her homesickness, which she did sometimes, would have not been quite the right thing to do. Yeah. So they're always mediating herself in the in the writing. Yeah. So what, going back to Edith, was she by nature a private person? Do you think that's why she asked for her documents to be destroyed? Or was there something else happening?
No, I think she was quite a private person. I think she had a persona that she presented to the world, and she was very firm in that. And I think, I mean, she suffered from, that was one of the things I discovered in the course of the writing, was that she suffered from Meniere's disease and was quite ill in her later years. And I didn't realise, you know, some of the things I'd read earlier in her life, I suddenly realised they were, that was the early stages of that condition. And she suffered very badly from it and lost her hearing through operations to try and correct the problem, and it took a long time for it to be diagnosed. So once I discovered that, that changed a lot of the things, my interpretation of what had happened in her life, you know, why her daughter, one of her daughters, stayed home and never married, and sort of helped her with her work and things. It kind of had something that hadn't really made sense to me before. Suddenly I realised why that was essential, because she was quite incapacitated at times. With that condition.
Can you talk a little bit more about the science that she was doing? She had this quite seemingly conventional life. She's a housewife, but doing amazing science, like unheralded science. She fixed up some problems that people hadn't been able to figure out.
Yes, amazing. I think she's a real, you know, she was a very old school observer of nature. So she engaged in very close observation, but she also had a really careful critical mind in terms of thinking through alternatives and ruling out, you know, different explanations for things. So she would approach things quite systematically. And that was the case with her, the thing she is most famous for, which is the discovery of pseudocopulation. The puzzle was about how orchids manage pollination, that they have a flower but they don't produce nectar, and so why do insects come and pollinate them? And Darwin was really puzzled by this. He called this one of the great mysteries. And Edith had observed wasps associating with orchids. So she did some, you know, she looked into this quite carefully, and through a series of quite careful experiments over the season, worked out that it was always male wasps, that they were clearly attracted by scent, and that they appeared to be mating with the orchids. So and you know, she identified that they were even leaving little sperm packages on the orchids. So she did this quite systematically with over a number of presumably a couple of weeks, I suppose, and then repeated again the following season, and then checked if this was happening with other species of orchids, and that made quite a stir. So other people, there were a couple of other naturalists who had observed this behaviour and thought that this was the case, but it was really Edith who nailed it and said it's not any of the other theories. It's definitely the male wasps think the female orchid, that orchid is a female wasp and is mating with it, and that's the trade-off. Instead of getting food, they're getting sex.
Interesting. Where did she get the training to work that out?
She seems to have been completely self-taught. So she attributes her interest in nature to her father, who was a builder, and a, you know, general, worked as a gardener and all sorts of different things in different times. So she just seems to have been a naturalist, if you like. And she was very well read. So she was an extremely good, you know, widely read person. So it's quite clear her work is filled with literary references. So reading across the board, not just scientific stuff, but also poetry and all sorts of things. So she's just self-taught, I think. And she also makes a very strong point of she was an exceptional letter writer, of which very few have survived. But we know that she was an exceptional letter writer because people say she was. And so she was communicating with people. So if she didn't know something, she'd write and find out. And she used to get responses from people, I think, because she would also send them specimens. So she was a collector for other people. And people valued her for that too, as well as for her expertise.
Oh, were these mostly people within Australia that she was corresponding with?
No, she communicated overseas as well. So she had really good links with, she'd written to Oakes Ames at Harvard University. So, and he was actually quite influential in promoting her work. She'd written to, you know, English people in England as well, who were a little bit more stuffy about it, but eventually agreed that she was pretty good too.
Wow, that's great. Very interesting story. At the beginning of your book, you mentioned how through Edith's writing we can renew our acquaintance with our lost nature writing history. Can you elaborate on that a little bit?
I guess the thing, this is again one of these things about, you know, coming from a science background, that, you know, people often say that Australia doesn't have a nature writing tradition. And yet I was always really puzzled by that, because I think that Australia's has had lots of nature writers. But I think the people I think of as nature writers tend to be science writers. So people like Edith, who perhaps other people haven't considered as part of the nature writing tradition, because they don't write about themselves. You know, I think we have a very Thoreau-influenced view of nature writing that has to be self-reflective. And to my mind, that's not my favourite sort of nature writing, the pondering, you know, navel-gazing kind of nature writing. And a lot of Australian nature writers were very, very externally focused. So they were looking out, and their own personal reflections don't really come into it. It's strongly observational. So it's just a different style, I think, of nature writing. So that's what I really wanted to reconnect with.
Why do you think there's that difference with the European and British, that difference to the European and British style of writing? Kathleen Jamie has a go at those lonely white men wandering the paddocks without encountering a single soul. It's a wonderful essay. It's very acerbic. Why do you think the Australian nature writing tradition differs to the British and American one?
Yeah, I don't really know. I don't know if you know, self-reflection is such a strong part of the Australian personality, I suppose, if there is such a thing. You know, it's not to say that Edith wasn't influenced by that. She, you know, there were, Richard Jefferies was one of her favourite authors, and he's definitely, you know, on the spiritual side of things. And Emerson was one of her favourite essayists. So it's not to say she wasn't reading those sorts of things, but she never did it herself. I'm not really sure why that's not... not so much a feature. But of course, more recently we've sort of come back to nature writing, and we're re-engaging with it through those more spiritualist kind of personal forms of nature writing. But I think it's good to recognise that it's a very broad field, and that there's a great wide range of different types of nature writing. I mean, personally, I'd like to include field guides in nature writing, because I love reading field guides. I think they're a great form of writing. And Ursula Heiss would say that conservation legislation is a form of nature writing. I'm all for that broad brushstroke. It's all about how we engage with nature in all its different levels.
Yeah. And how did you come to writing after or while being a scientist. So you were working in zoology in Oxford, and then you're on the Outer Hebrides. So what prompted a shift away from that into the literary?
Oh, well, that was a fairly practical decision, really. I guess I started doing science writing during my PhD, and then immediately afterwards, while I was applying for postdocs and grants and jobs and things, and the science writing just took off, I suppose. So I got a few jobs. Actually, I had a job at the Museum of Victoria as a research essayist quite early on in my career.
That's a nice job.
That was a lovely job. I've been using that, the stuff I learned in that job, ever since. Edith Holman was one of the stories that came out of that work. So the French Voyages was another one of the stories that came out of that work. So that was a really rich position to have for a while, and really informed a lot of what I did. So it was just convenient. And then when I had a family, it was a particularly convenient thing to continue doing, and it gave me a lot of flexibility. And I've always loved writing, so that was something I'd always been interested in anyway.
Yeah. And do you have any more books planned, or are you having a rest?
Well, I've just finished one. So I have one coming out in October.
Oh, your koala book, that's right. Yeah.
Yes. Koalas. The koala book is coming out. But I always say I'm going to have a rest, but we'll just see what happens.
And I'm just wondering, because you do attend to these overlooked stories, particularly about women. Is that something that you're going to keep like following and researching?
I don't think I've actually got a plan for what I'm going to research. It's just what story pops up and what intersects with what publishers are interested in. I always write my books in conjunction with a publisher, so it's planned with a publisher usually, or I approach a publisher with a particular project, and if they're interested, then that's what I'll write. So I don't always have it's not just my decision.
That's a very collaborative way of working. I have a long list of books in my head, and it's just whenever I have time to get to the next one. I usually write most of it before I send it to the publisher. I'm always terrified of getting writer's block. Expectation of me that I won't be able to meet it.
I have always written on commission. There's only one book, which was the book I wrote while I was the research essayist. That's the only one I've written just on spec, apart from a couple of novels, which I still haven't had published. I'd much rather write on commission, personally.
With the novels, is your style very different to the nonfiction?
Well, I hope so. I think they need to be a bit different for the novels. I don't know. It's a bit hard to judge your own writing.
Yeah, it is.
I think most of my books are pretty diverse in actual fact. Even in non-fiction, some are more straightforward narrative nonfiction, and then you've got the fragmentary biographies, which are quite a different style. Voyages to the South Seas is a series of essays, but written from the perspective of one of the characters, so it's more of a reconstruction. So they're reconstructed scenes. And Continents of Curiosity is collected essays. They're all very different in format. I do like writing different things.
I like that too. You can get a bit bored otherwise.
Well,
I look forward to the koala book. Is it September or October?
October.
If you've enjoyed this podcast, please consider sharing or leaving us a review. It really helps young podcasts like ours reach more listeners. We love to hear from you on email, Twitter, Instagram, or Facebook. And you can find more writers and writing inspired by science on our website, scienceRightNow.com. Science Right Now is sponsored by the Australia Council for the Arts, hosted by Amanda Niehaus and Jessica White, and produced by Taylor Mitchell. Thanks so much for listening.